Hello, I'm Rupert Soskin.
And I'm Michael Bott. Welcome to another Prehistory Guys interview, introducing you to archaeologists and historians, usually, all too often, hidden behind the scenes. But in this case, not hidden at all, and to be honest, not even an archaeologist.
That's very true. Today we are delighted to be talking with Professor Alice Roberts, in our view, one of the finest communicators you'll find in the world of archaeology and prehistory.
Before becoming a writer and presenter, Alice's career began as a medical doctor. She went on to become a university lecturer, teaching human anatomy, developing a particular expertise and doing a PhD in paleopathology, the study of disease in ancient human remains. Through a circuitous route, this led her to working as a bone specialist with the renowned archaeology series Time Team, and then on to presenting several of her own landmark television series.
She has won numerous awards, perhaps most notably being the first recipient of the Royal Society David Attenborough Award in 2020. Her books are always a joy to read, and her latest title, Ancestors, The Prehistory of Britain in Seven Burials, is so relevant to everything the Prehistory Guys are about that it seemed the perfect time to get her on to talk about that, along with her thoughts about many other aspects of her work. We hope you enjoy our chat as much as we did. Professor Alice Roberts, thank you so much for joining us, and welcome to the show.
We always
start our interviews with the same question. We always ask, what was it that first got you into archaeology? And the thing is, we can't help thinking this isn't quite such a straightforward question for you. So I'm going to put it this way. So how did medical doctor, osteologist, biologist, anthropologist, author, presenter, illustrator Alice Roberts find herself in the glamorous world of archaeology?
Yeah, it's a tricky one, isn't it? Because I'm not an archaeologist. As you say, I'm a medic originally, and that's kind of what I decided to do when I was a child. I think it was about 11 when I made up my mind that I was going to do something with science and people, and that it was medicine. And I was also fascinated with human anatomy, so that's been my kind of enduring fascination all the way through. And I thoroughly expected when I left medical school that I was going on to a career in surgery. That's kind of the bit of medicine and surgery that had really kind of grabbed me. And then I did a 6-month job at Bristol University teaching anatomy to medical students, and had the opportunity to start doing a bit of research. And there was a really interesting research group who were looking at, well, for me, you know, it was my kind of particular interest, looking at archaeological human bones. Mm. I've kind of been exposed to it a bit during my undergrad years, because I had a tutor who was a retired surgeon, Richard Newell, who would bring in archaeological human bones to show us arthritis and other diseases in the bones. So I'd got really fascinated with that then. And so when I was anatomy demonstrating at Bristol University, I'd be cutting up dead bodies and teaching medical students in the dissection room. And then on days when I wasn't doing that, or afternoons when I wasn't doing that, I'd go down to the basement of the old Bristol Royal Infirmary and look at archaeological human remains. There was a massive collection that Juliet Rogers, who led the research group, was looking at from Barton-on-Humber, of medieval skeletons. And I learnt to lay out these skeletons with Louise Lowe, who's an osteologist who works for Oxford Archaeological Unit now. And I was just fascinated by how much you could tell from bones. Mm. Because as a medic, I thought, well, you know, surely you can't tell that much. You know, okay, you can spot arthritis, but what else can you tell from a skeleton? Because, you know, they're patients that are long gone. You can't ask them about their history. Yeah. You can't, you know, say, when did this start hurting? Where does it hurt? Maybe I'll do some blood tests. No, there's no blood. So you're very limited, but there are some things you can do. So there are obviously techniques that we use clinically that we can also use with old bones, like x-rays, CT scans. And actually you can tell an awful lot from somebody's skeleton. So that became my area of research, and I got sidelined into academia and carried on as an anatomist in terms of my teaching, but as a biological anthropologist, which is largely focused on osteology, in my research. So that's how it happened, really. And then the kind of television career came about because of that. So I wasn't looking for a career in television. I wasn't looking to become an author either.
Yeah.
But I started writing bone reports for Time Team. Yeah. They had all these bones, all these skeletons they dug up that they needed to have reports on. So I was writing reports for them. And then in 2001, so 20 years ago, they invited me along to come along and be a bone expert on screen as well. And that was it. That was the beginning of my career in television.
Yeah, yeah.
Amazing.
Did Time Team itself, I mean, did the interest in archaeology get sparked from being on Time Team? That's kind of that way
well,
around.
I'd been interested before, yeah. Definitely. And Time Team's been interesting. I caught up very recently, just a couple of weekends ago, yeah. with Phil Harding.
Oh, sweet.
We were opening a new Bronze Age house at Butts at Ancient Farm, which is so lovely, which is full of...
Oh, we must go down there.
Age houses, but also Bronze Age houses now, yeah. and a Roman villa. And we were chatting about it, and I said to him, it was lovely to work on Time Team because I'd really enjoyed the programme. You know, I'd been really interested in archaeology. Yeah. And I'd really, I'd kind of watched the programme from the start, really, and then ended up working on it myself.
How perfect.
Which felt really special.
How perfect. Yeah. So, Alice, your book, Ancestors, latest book, which came out in May this year. My goodness,
it did,
how time flies.
Yeah.
Now, it's received huge praise from all quarters, and if we can add our small voice of congratulations to the mix, I think absolutely beautiful read, and so much more than just a review of what we think we know about people in the past. Now, the subtitle of the book is The Prehistory of Britain in Seven Burials. Of the seven burials that you talk about, that you write about in the book, which for you was the most profound or rewarding for you to explore, do you think?
That's a really tricky one because they're all very different stories, which is partly why I chose them, because they all have different stories to tell. I'm a bit obsessed with The Red Lady of Haviland, so I did enjoy writing that particular chapter and researching that story in more detail.
Yeah.
I knew the story quite well, but there were so many things that I didn't know, and I didn't know, for instance, that the whole archive of letters between the Reverend William Buckland and Lady Mary Cole on the Gower existed.
Yeah.
And so reading that correspondence between the two of them, and also finding out that it was, it was women that first discovered Haviland Cave.
Yes. That is the eternal shock, isn't it?
So we remember Buckland's name, but we forget Lady Mary Cole and her daughters. So Haviland Cave, but I think probably the Amesbury Archer actually is the most evocative for me.
Yeah.
It's just such an astonishing burial.
Yeah.
This Bronze Age burial, 4,500 years ago, and is just a brilliant example of how much we can tell now by looking at skeletons with all the new techniques that we've got at our fingertips. Mm. And of course, running through the book as well is this story of the engagement between two, well, they have been very different fields, archaeology and genetics.
Yeah.
And now the two are coming together, and the amazing stories that we can now tell based on ancient DNA extraction from old bones and resolving debates that you just would have no hope of resolving otherwise. And then also even, with the Amesbury Archer, working out from the chemical composition of his teeth that he grew up somewhere a very long way away from Salisbury Plain, probably somewhere around the Alps. So it's just, it's astonishing to be able to extract all of that biographical information from a skeleton.
Mm.
Yes, it's certainly true that the discipline is changing enormously, isn't it? But it seems incredible that it's over 10 years since your book and landmark BBC series The Incredible Human Journey came out. You spent a lot of time with various ethnic groups for that, sitting on the ground, sharing time and space with people living ostensibly primitive lives. Did those experiences influence your approach to, and indeed interpretations of, the past when you were writing Ancestors?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that was a really kind of, I'd say a formative year for me. I took a year off from the university Finished my PhD, which I realised I was never going to write up if I didn't take some time off teaching. And it was a part-time PhD, so it had gone on for seven years.
Oh, I didn't realise you were still doing your PhD when, oh my goodness, yeah.
Yeah, no, it went on. Because I was, you know, I didn't do it full-time. I did it at the same time as teaching doing other research as well. So it was a bit of a long haul, but I got there in the end. So I wrote up my PhD, and then in the remainder of that year break that I took from the university, I went off and filmed this series, which was... you know, really big budget, very kind of, well, global reach. You know, we travelled all around the world. Kind of series that the BBC just doesn't seem to be making anymore, actually, with those really kind of broad ambitions. And what we were doing was setting out to tell the story of the ancient colonisation of the world by our species, by Homo sapiens, and looking at the fossil evidence, the archaeological evidence, the evidence of ancient cultures, but also what we had at the time in terms of genetic insights as well, which, you know, today, even just 10 years later, quite limited, actually. But we could see broad brushstrokes by looking at the sorts of studies that were being carried out on tiny bits of DNA, like mitochondrial DNA, which represents only a very small amount of the DNA in your cells. Mm-hmm. And Y chromosome DNA. I mean, now we're reading whole genomes, which is astonishing. But even just reading those small bits of DNA, you can map out the expansion of the human species across the world. So we were kind of trying to do that thing of bringing together archaeology and genetics, and at the same time, as you say, visiting all sorts of different indigenous communities around the world, and that was amazing. So the people I met made a real impact on me that year, from the experts that I was meeting and interviewing to the indigenous communities that I had the joy of spending time with. And it is that, you know, that luxury of spending time and meeting people that you just... I can't imagine how else I would have met those people. Yeah. I had similar experiences on subsequent series. So I did a series called Origins of Us, which I always find difficult to say because we all called it Oranges. Oranges of Us. So I had similar experiences there. And I remember going out to spend some time with a group of Hadza people in Tanzania. And the wonderful thing about going and doing that as part of a filming project is that we were travelling with an anthropologist who knew this group extremely well, Alyssa Crittenden, and it was absolutely brilliant because we kind of turned up to film with this small community, and you know, we'd sort of driven for hours and hours and hours to get to them, and they'd kind of come out a bit to find us as well, and they set up a new camp and we set up a camp next to them. And they just, you know, Alyssa introduced us, and we had translators as well, and Alyssa could obviously translate too, and they just greeted us as friends of a friend, and we were able to have amazing conversations with them, and it was all the conversations that went on outside what we were filming as well. So I was filming and talking to them about the place of children in their society and reproduction and kind of divided roles between men and women and diet and all sorts of things like that. But aside from that, you know, we'd have these conversations about, again, about families. I mean, they were fascinated by my family. I was fascinated by their families. And just being able to spend time with people who live very, very different lives. You know, they were equally fascinated by us as we were with them. They were asking me, I had a baby at the time, and they were asking me questions about where this baby was, who was feeding her, because she was 11 months old. And Alyssa was saying, be careful, because they think you've told them that your husband's looking after her. They think he might be breastfeeding her. because they had no idea about bottled milk, about formula milk or anything like that. Yeah. And then they were saying, is it true that you wrap your babies in rags and leave them to urinate and defecate in those rags? And I was like, yes, it is.
Kind of.
And they were saying, why don't you just wipe them up as soon as they go? That's what we do. Yeah. And I was kind of trying to explain it wasn't quite as warm in England as it was in Tanzania. Do you let your babies sleep in a different place from you? Do you have your babies sleeping in a different place? Why don't you have them with you? Aren't you scared?
Goodness.
If you put them somewhere away from you, all these questions. Oh, is it true that you go to the toilet in your houses? Why do you want to go to the toilet in your houses? It was really interesting. Yeah. You kind of go, yeah, okay, all good questions. Yeah.
But also the curiosity as well. Isn't that fascinating?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, it was really interesting. I mean, that particular trip for me, I kind of came back from that going, we don't need all the stuff that we think we need, particularly around having babies. You know, there's this kind of, I mean, I felt like that anyway, yeah. And it just kind of enhanced it for me that there was this real, I had this real profound feeling that I was just giving birth to a new consumer, yeah. And that even before I had this baby,
yeah. Oh, my goodness.
Companies were getting in touch with me. You know, the midwives were trying to hand me this bounty pack with lots of vouchers and trying to hook me into all these companies because it's, you know, they can sell more stuff. There's a new person in the world, and I hated it. And I came back from the Hadza in particular, just going, right, really don't need much stuff. Yeah. And certainly with my first child, I didn't even have a pram. I was very much, right, this is what you do. You carry your baby round.
Wow.
And that, so I was quite influenced by them in that respect.
Yeah, yeah.
That idea that you just have your baby next to you.
Yeah.
That's what they did. They'd have a kind of fabric sling that they just put the baby in. And so that's what I did too.
We could talk for ever about this.
We could.
Because, I mean, we give ourselves the remit, you know, through prehistoric archaeology, you know, is trying to get as close to people as possible, not just explain the archaeology and, you know, have a narrative, you know, in the technical terms and academic terms to tell, but also, as far as we can, getting close to people. And, yeah, of course, it's always tinged with our own experiences and all the rest of it.
No, that really is one of the wonderful things about your books, you know, because you weave together, you take the archaeological evidence and you weave it into a story that, or into a narrative that really does bring the past to life. And that's just so rare, you know. You know, making those comparisons between these modern day, ostensibly primitive societies and the past, you know, just bringing the past to life. As Mike said, it's all about the people.
It
and
is,
sometimes
it is.
We get obsessed with the bling and the artifacts, but it's about the people.
Yeah. No, yeah. I mean, I think even when you look at the bling and the artifacts, what you're thinking about, aren't you, is who made them? Why did they make them? What did they mean? You know, what did it mean to the person who owned those objects? And it is all about getting in touch with people. You're right, it is. And it's about imagining those past lives. And I think that ethnographic studies, so looking at other communities around the world, primitive's a difficult term, isn't it? I mean, they're living lives, you know, people like the Hadza, people like the Bushmen in Namibia are living lives which are much more basic, I suppose. But even that brings kind of a value judgment with it. But it's without the trappings of, you know, the technological trappings, I suppose, of developed countries in modern society. And I suppose what ethnography does for us is it doesn't show us exactly how people were living in the past. Of course it can't. And then we also shouldn't see those communities as being somehow you know, preserved in aspic primitive societies that have just carried on doing the same thing. But it can certainly open our eyes to the types of societies that people were living in, the organisation of those societies, what's important to people through time, the technologies that they're using, all of those things. So I think it helps us with our hypotheses rather than giving us a definitive answer. It can't give us a definitive answer. But it is, I mean, it is amazing. I've spent time with reindeer herders in Siberia as well, and that's utterly fascinating. Fascinating to see how you know, their lifestyle means that they can, you know, survive in, I think it probably is the most inhospitable place on the planet. When you get up into the far Arctic and it gets down to -70 in the winters.
Yes.
It's horrendous.
Challenging.
Yeah. Yeah. And you kind of go there thinking, how are they surviving there with, you know, sort of, I suppose, the minimal of minimum technological equipment. Or, you know, I remember going to one particular group, and they said, we're not going to take you anywhere if you wear your Baffin Explorer boots that you've brought with you. You need to put reindeer fur boots on. And they were right. The reindeer fur boots were so much better than what we brought with us.
Right.
We spent a lot of money on gear, and it wasn't good enough. And it wasn't as good as the fur.
Yeah. One of my favourite things in the Pitt Rivers Museum is a raincoat made out of seal intestines.
Mm.
Probably works very well indeed.
Yeah, but it smells a bit, though.
I digress slightly. Anyway. Keeping incredible human journey in mind, for ancestors, though, you did some work with Tom Booth at the Crick Institute.
Yeah, I'm involved with this incredible project running out of the Crick. So the most ambitious ancient DNA project in Britain to date. So 1,000 ancient genomes, and that is Pontus Skoglund's lab of which Tom Booth is a researcher, and Pooja Swali as well. He's also amazing. He's doing metagenomics, looking at the genomes of other things that are not human. So when you sample DNA from old bones, you obviously get the DNA of that individual person, but you also get loads of bacteria, some of which are going to be bacteria from the soil, but some of them are, you know, pathogens that were around in that person's body, viruses as well. Yeah, so she's hoping to look at pathogens through time. She's already got some really interesting results, actually. It's a really exciting big project that will lead to some answers to some of the enduring questions. I mean, I want to know how many Anglo-Saxons came over, if they did, you know.
Going there. But the real question was then, Alistair, the kind of developments that you know, the Tom Booth and others like him are producing, I mean, almost on a daily basis now, does any of that make you want to go back and revisit some of the past projects you've done in the light of
funny you should say that. Because I've been writing the follow-up to Ancestors. So this takes us into the historical period and into the world of the Romans, the Anglo-Saxons and the Vikings. And while I was writing the Anglo-Saxon chapter, I was reading about some quite recent revelations about the arrival of the Justinianic plague in Britain. So the Justinianic plague sweeps through Europe in the 6th century. And we've got very, very good documentary evidence for that. But we've got no documentary evidence of it in Britain. We've got very patchy history, I would say, from the 5th and 6th century anyway. Mm. So we're largely relying on archaeology for those centuries, those kind of post-Roman centuries. And I was reading about this particular cemetery at Edict Hill in Suffolk, I think, where they had managed to find some Yersinia pestis DNA in that cemetery. So Yersinia pestis is the pathogen that causes the plague. And that cemetery had a number of double and triple burials in it. And I looked at them and I thought, they look very, very similar to a particular cemetery that I've worked on, where there were double and triple burials. And a bit curious because they were well-furnished graves, and I think you kind of expect that if somebody's been laid low by the plague, they're going to be hurriedly buried and without a lot of grave goods. But Edict Hill had plenty of grave goods buried with people, and yet we know that there were people there who were suffering from the plague. So we've managed to track down those skeletons, and I think Tom has already sequenced them. So we may be able to see if this other cemetery, which is in Hampshire, is also evidence of the Justinianic plague in Britain. Yeah. And that cemetery is the very first cemetery that I've worked on for Time Team.
Wow.
So, going back to 2001.
Wow.
It was my first Time Team dig.
Amazing cycle. Yeah.
Full circle.
Yeah.
Well, I want to ask you about Tamed. Tamed, 10 Species That Changed Our World. It's a remarkable book, not least of all because of the wealth of diverse detail that you had to research for many of the stories that you've woven together with such clarity. You know, But similar to our question about ancestors, which of those 10 species do you think has had the greatest impact on the evolution of humanity? And you're not allowed to say humans. For anyone who hasn't read the book, humans are number 10 in the book. So.
Because we've domesticated ourselves, you see. we could sneak ourselves in as well. Yeah, it's a tricky one. I mean, this is a book that I wanted to write because I'm interested in the way that archaeology and genetics are allowing us to reveal the deep history of humans. And I thought, you must be able to do that for other species. I got a bit obsessed with it. I was writing articles for The Observer as well about the origin of reindeer and blackberries and all these... Just basically anything, any species you like, and you could use genetics and archaeology together to work out the origin of these species and their stories. But with Tamed, I chose ones that had had this relationship with humans and had been domesticated by humans and so much part of our world. So dogs, horses, chickens, and plants as well. So potatoes, wheat, maize. Fascinating story. So which one do I think had the most impact? It's really tricky. It's really difficult because I think it's probably the cereal crops, actually, and maybe not the animals so much. But, I mean, horses have caused an amazing transformation. And you end up kind of thinking about those kind of alternative histories about, what human history would have looked like without domesticated horses. And I think the history of warfare would have been completely different because very quickly horses are used for raiding and then formal cavalry pretty quickly. And of course, transport, moving, bulk movement of goods and people that wasn't really possible before. So I think you could probably make an argument. It depends what your criteria are. I think it probably still has to be wheat, actually, because without those cereal crops, those founder crops of the Neolithic, and if I can be permitted to say wheat and the other cereals, so in the Fertile Crescent, that would have included oats and rye. In East Asia, it includes rice and millet. Those founder crops were just essential to the beginning of the Neolithic and the expansion, the massive population expansion that we then get in the Neolithic with that, having those staple crops. So I think, probably it is the cereal crops, but I would like to make an argument for horses as well.
I found it fascinating, actually, that the way you described in that the serendipity of it all, the fact that it wouldn't have been people deliberately choosing this, that, and the other. It would have been, I think the example that you gave of when people would have noticed where they had been bringing in wild grains, and that stuff just would have started growing where they'd been working. Those sorts of ideas that it's only when somebody kind of presents you with these sorts of alternative views of the past, if you like, that you realise, okay, that makes sense. That makes complete sense.
Oh, I'm really glad, Rupert. Because it's, we do tend to tell these, I think, overly heroic stories, and I've probably been guilty of this myself. but we do love to paint our ancestors in a good light. I mean, that's you don't speak ill of the dead kind of thing. And also, you want your own ancestor to have been heroic, and undoubtedly amongst our ancestors, we were deeply unheroic. But I also think a lot of these advances, we sort of paint it in colours where we talk about human ingenuity and the pioneering spirit and all of those kind of things, and I think an awful lot of it is just people going, oh, look at that. Didn't expect that, but it works, let's do that. And what's interesting, of course, is that actually that's how a lot of science today works as well. And we write it up in our scientific papers as though we knew exactly what was going to happen when we did this particular experiment and it went wrong and we had a much more exciting result than we would have anticipated. And we write it up as though we knew that was going to happen all along. It is like that. So maybe a bit more humility is needed.
Yeah. Actually, my next question kind of follows on from that a little bit, Alice. It may interest you to know that we share certain views about some of the presumptions that persist in the world of prehistoric archaeology. How can I put this? Last chapter of our book, Standing with Stones, accompanied the film, was called Temple What Temple?
Oh, brilliant. Yes.
Would you like to say a few words about SSSDs?
Yes, I would. Yes. So I think it's really difficult, isn't it? Again, you know, we like to speak well of our ancestors. And I think there's also a tendency for, you know, if we're associated or we're studying a particular site, we want it to be something special. We want it to be more than just a village, you know, another village, another settlement. And there is this thing about the R word in archaeology where if you can't work out what something is and you can't think of a mundane explanation, then you go for a ritual.
I didn't say what an SSSD was.
No, you didn't say what an SSSD was. So an SSSD is my invention for this very particular pitfall for archaeologists, which is that if they get obsessed with their site being something very, very, very special, and potentially a ritual site where it could have mundane explanations, then they end up with a site of special sacred delusion. And there are quite a lot of those around the place. And I think it is something which we should be teaching our undergraduate archaeologists to really, really beware. I'm a medic, you know. I come at archaeology unashamedly saying I'm not archaeologically trained. I'm pretty handy with a trowel. My training is medicine, and I do frame everything in a kind of medical way. But I mean, I think that's kind of useful. Other people might think I'm being naive, or I don't know. But in medicine, common things are common. You know, when you're looking for a diagnosis, you're trying to diagnose somebody, you don't go for the most exotic possible disease. You don't say, well, you've got a few spots, it must be some really exotic tropical disease that you've got. You go, well, you know, maybe you've got chickenpox. So I think it's the same, you know, we should have the same approach in archaeology. Common things are common, rather than just going, well, I like the idea of it being something really special and rare, so let's plump for that. But I, you know, my husband's more mundane in his explanation. So he is an actual archaeologist, and we met at university. So that may have influenced me as well over my career in many ways. But he always, I mean, he's a field archaeologist. He's quite kind of just grounded in his explanations about things. And I don't know if there's a difference between field archaeologists, and I don't want to diss academic archaeologists. I know lots of amazing academic archaeologists whose interpretations are just brilliant, and, you know, extremely thoughtful. Maybe in the past, let's put them in the past, there have been, you know, academic archaeologists who've tended towards these kind of rather overblown interpretations, let's say, or explanations. There are certainly some objects where I've said, well, I can't think of any other explanation other than that they must be ritual. And the one that really springs to mind are the so-called red deer headdresses from Star Car in Yorkshire, which are Mesolithic. Yeah. So they're frontlets, so the front bit of a red deer skull with the antlers attached. And they've got holes pierced in them. So the interpretation for decades has been that these are headdresses. And I kind of wrap my brains about it thinking, I don't know what else they are, actually. I mean, it may be that they could be nailed up to something, I don't know, and that they could be a decoration on a wall. But they do look like ritual objects. And, you know, maybe headdresses is the best interpretation. And I told that to my husband, and he said, well, let's have a look at them then. And we had a look at pictures of them. And he said, they could have been coat hooks. It's like, oh, they could have been coat hooks. And when I was on tour a couple of years ago, and I did a kind of Ask the Audience project, and went up and down the country showing people pictures of the Star Car headdresses and going, what do you think they are? I told them this brilliant story of them being, you know, sort of involved in headdresses for hunting rituals and, you know, all of this kind of thing that we've got no idea of because it's Mesolithic and we've just sort of lost in the mists of time. And then told them about my husband and his idea of coat hooks. And then I'd ascertain the kind of level of support for each of those theories from the audience. And what was fascinating was the variation up and down the country. So the further north I went, the more sensible people were. And they really preferred the mundane explanation. The further south they came, the more mystical people were, and they liked the more ritualized explanation.
Fascinating.
It wasn't just south and north though; it was also east and west. As I got down into the south, and I reckon, and this is a hypothesis I need to do some more work on, but I reckon it's proximity to Glastonbury. I reckon Glastonbury is peak mysticism in the UK. The closer you are to Glastonbury, the more likely you are to prefer a mystical answer.
This is my theory, and yes,
it does make sense, doesn't it? We have such an issue about so many of these things that the biggest one for us is Henges. I'm not going to bang on, but you take, for example, you've got Devil's Quoits in Oxfordshire, that the excavation report, it's just full of so many cattle bones, and then you go to Coupland Henge up north, which is the oldest henge in Britain. Coupland Henge has got drove roads running through it and high phosphate levels in the soil analysis, you know, and yet we still regard henges as temples instead of animals there. It is the go-to explanation, isn't it? So, we do lovely. Like your SSSDs.
Again, we could talk for quite a long
time. We could talk for a very long time about that. Anyway, moving on. Changing the subject entirely, really, we've heard you speak about scientists being public servants. And we've had chats with our good friend Professor Tim Darvill about archaeology's duty or obligation, if you like, to give back to society. And, you know, he pioneered Human Henge as a way of using prehistoric sites as a means of helping with public mental health, for example. So in your role as Professor of Public Engagement in Science, do you think archaeology could or should be doing more?
I think it could be doing more. But actually, I think that, looking across the country and looking across, thinking about university archaeology for a minute rather than archaeology more broadly, yeah. I think that our university archaeology departments have got some of the best public engagement in our universities. Mm-hmm. Archaeology seems to have been very kind of open to public engagement from a very early point in time. I mean, I think it's been really interesting over the course of my career to see public engagement as an idea, and it's such a clunky term, but essentially universities talking with the public and very much in dialogue, having a conversation, not just talking at the public, but having a conversation, a two-way flow of information. That idea has gone from being quite a fringe idea, I think, even 20 years ago. And the idea of doing any kind of communication outside the university was certainly, when I was in Bristol, viewed as, you know, something you did in your spare time, you know, in weekends and evenings. It wasn't part of core academic work. It wasn't seen as part of the core remit of a university. And again, I think it's some of it's my naivety, coming from my background in medicine, that it never occurred to me not to talk about my subject outside the bounds of the university. It just wasn't it wasn't even an option that I wouldn't, because I think, you know, my whole training and my career up to that point had been about the public and about science in public and with the public. And I think we're in a very, very different place now. But I think that archaeology departments grasped that very, very early on. And I don't think it's, it's not surprising that Time Team itself as a television idea came about because of McAston in Bristol. You know, it was basically his idea with Tony Robinson. Tony Robinson spent a summer digging with him in Santorini, and they cooked up this idea of an archaeology TV programme that they thought nobody would watch. But Mick, spent so much of his time engaging with history societies, you know, local communities in all sorts of different ways, and very much saw archaeology as a subject that was all about the public. I mean, what is the point in trying to work out the past if you're not then sharing it with everybody? It belongs to everybody. I feel that about university research then much more broadly. You know, and as I have said before, scientists are public servants. We are largely paid for by public money. We're working on different areas of science that will benefit the public in all sorts of different ways. But we don't want those benefits to be limited to just the output at the end of a research project. Yeah. You want it to also be about culture more broadly. And actually, the research can be better, I think, if we engage the public early on in research projects.
Yeah. Oh, well, do you know what? I mean, the time is flying along, I'm afraid. And, gee, I can see... Well, as I said before, we could talk for a long time. But before we finish, Alice, I just wanted to just kind of backtrack. Oops, sorry. Wanted to backtrack a little and ask you, someone who's well aware of the influence of contingency and serendipity and mm-hmm. the little bifurcations that happen in life. In another universe, there is an Alice Roberts that is a surgeon. Mm. What do you think she would think about the Alice Roberts in this universe, the Alice Roberts that's the polymath?
Goodness me. I mean, I do think this. I do kind of imagine, my career having headed off in different directions. I think I would have been completely happy and fulfilled as a paediatric surgeon. That's what I wanted to do. Mm. So I was lucky enough to do one of my house jobs doing surgery on infants and children, and I loved all aspects of that job, the craft of the surgery itself, but also the engaging with children. So I would have been very happy. I think maybe I would have carried on watching programs about archaeology and reading books about archaeology, and I think I'd view that other me kind of curiously, but not necessarily. I think I would have been just as happy. It would have been like, I could have done that, but done this instead.
Yeah,
so, but I feel very lucky. I feel very lucky to have ended up doing what I'm doing. I mean, it is every day I'm learning new things, and I feel as though that's a kind of very privileged position to be in. And then I really, really enjoy sharing those stories with a wider audience.
And it's the enthusiasm for them. I mean, there's like you say, you've been lucky, and we make our own luck to a certain degree. But it's the enthusiasm and maintaining that enthusiasm. Well, I mean, the enthusiasm seems to come naturally, and that's what shines out, and is the basis of
it's in communication.
Thank you. Well, I genuinely enjoy doing what I do. So
there you go.
It shows. Alice, you're going back on tour shortly. In fact, it's next week, isn't it?
It is. 1st of November, I think, is the first date.
So what are you talking about, and where can people come to see you? Unless it's sold out already. Is your whole tour sold out?
I don't know. I haven't checked on tickets, actually. It was selling really fast, but I'm sure there are some tickets left. It's a little bespoke tour, because it's the first time I've been on tour for a couple of years because of events of the past couple of years.
Indeed.
I'm really looking forward to getting out back in front of live audiences again. I love talking to people. And I'll be talking about ancestors, but I'll also be talking about some behind-the-scenes stories as well from various filming exploits, and also potentially spilling some of the beans on the brand new series of Digging for Britain, which will be on our screens either late at the end of this year or just into 2022. Some amazing new archaeology. So I'm in Bristol, Frome, Exeter, Cardiff, Oxford. I think that's it. There might be a couple more, but check out the website.
Fantastic. Well,
this has come to an end much too soon. However, it's been an absolute joy talking to you, and I hope it's not been too much of an ordeal for you.
It's been really fascinating. Thank you very much for the conversation. I've really enjoyed talking to you too.
That's lovely.
I'm going to go
thank
and watch
you.
All your back catalogue now.
Well, good luck with that. Anyway, but thank you, Alice, and thank you guys for watching out there. I do hope you enjoyed that, and if you did, please do consider supporting us through our Patreon page and liking and subscribing and all that stuff. So that's it, I'm afraid. It's goodbye from me, and it's goodbye from him.
Yeah, it's a goodbye from me. Yes,
it's goodbye from me too.
Goodbye from Alice.
Thanks so much, Alice.
Cheers.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.